All right, so I guess now I'll switch gears a little bit, and talk about strategic deficit irrigation in maize in Colorado. So, so the area of Colorado where this study was taken is in the area that's irrigated. So we are just east of the Rocky Mountains, and this area are we are getting about 215 millimeters of precip, so we have very good growing conditions for maize, but it requires water inputs. So you get a little bit further east, and we get into some dry land regions, but I want to make a push for irrigated agriculture. Irrigated lands really are a minority of the agriculture out there. It is about 20% of the cultivated lands. So 80% is dry land or rain-fed. But these irrigated systems, although they're a minority, they're extremely important for stabilizing yield production and into the future, increasing yield production. So these 20% of the cultivated lands produce about 40% of the world's food supply. And the water, especially in arid systems, is getting more scarce. So not necessarily unavailable, but functionally unavailable when we talk about other demands on that water. So in our area, for example, we've got very high demands coming from municipal needs and also from oil and gas and other industrial needs. And these players can pay a lot more for the water, so then the water for agriculture becomes functionally unavailable. So one way or another, what we're looking for is to produce more with less. So, and switch gears a little bit and not necessarily focus on maximizing crop production, but maximizing water productivity, the amount of crop production per unit of water used by the system. Okay, so there are in different cropping systems, different plants, different systems, there are different responses to water, this relationship between yield and water. In most cases, in these agronomic crops that we are interested in, there is a linear relationship. If you look through the literature, almost all have found linear relationships. And what that means for deficit irrigation in these systems is that margin of production, productivity, is constant across the water used by the crop. So, and because, also notice that here we are showing, I very intentionally didn't put these lines through zero because it takes, there is an amount of water that it takes to get your first unit of yield. So you start basically with needing to put some water on to get that first unit of yield. So it really is, if you've got a linear response in these agronomic crops, it is going to be most profitable to give the maximum amount of water. And you're not going to want, there's no benefit then to doing deficit irrigation. Now, you get different slopes with different crops. C4 crops are going to have a steeper slope. But in all cases that it's linear, you want to, there's going to be no benefit to deficit irrigation. Now, that's not to say in other crops that isn't the case. So there are other situations where you could have a linear response, but it's still beneficial to do deficit irrigation because there are other benefits to that. So, for example, in grape and in apple, you could control, you could get higher quality fruit, and you could control some other costs that are extremely expensive for growers. These pruning costs, for example, which are very labor intensive. So there are additional benefits to deficit irrigation in other crops, even if there's a linear response. So what we're trying to do, though, is see if the predominant response is linear. We're trying to figure out how we can get a curvilinear response from these systems, this blue line here. So that was our first objective, was to see how we can manage the water to get a curvilinear response. And we also wanted to understand the physiological responses behind this yield-ET relationship. So it was very nice that Curtis gave a nice introduction to this idea of strategic deficit irrigation. In the system that I'm describing, basically we identified two targeted periods, and that's during this late vegetative we applied stress, and during the maturation phase as well. So we, like Curtis described, give a bit of, make sure that there is, if there's not a full profile coming into the growing season, we need to give even more water early to make sure that the plants have a good start. But then we can stress halfway through the vegetative period and until anthesis. Corn, of course, is extremely sensitive to and needs water during, once it goes into reproduction, you will get absolutely no yield if you don't have water. There will be abortion and no yield at all. And then our second stress period was during the maturation. That this graph here at the bottom I'm showing was a layout of the ideas that we wanted to test in our treatment. So we have the black diagonal, basically our treatments that are varying by the same amount in both of these two stress periods, from 40% of full ET to 100% of ET. And then we had other strategic deployment of water between these two phases by having either more 80% of full ET during the vegetative stress period or less water during the vegetative stress period and more water during the maturation period. Okay, so our research is in Greeley, Colorado. This is almost the tip of the rain shadow from the Rocky Mountains. So as the clouds come across the mountains, they drop precip in the mountains, and then as you go further away, we have sandy soils and very little precip. But we do have runoff from the mountains that gives us gives the farmers in the area water that they can use for irrigation. So we are high elevation and extremely dry with sandy soils. So actually I'll point out on this map here, our farm is about a 40 acre farm, and it's this area right here is what we're using for the experiments that I'm describing. And that's in this map, it's right here. And we have basically room to do two crops, and we rotate from one side to the other the crops for managing other management issues. And we have then, you can see in these pictures, we have basically 12 room for 12 treatments that are randomized across four blocks. And that's the map now that we have here. We have 12 treatments randomized and four blocks for each of the two crops that we swap between. So in these 2 years, we were working with corn and rotating between corn and sunflower. So you start imposing deficit irrigation and you get a pretty dramatic response in the crop. The first thing that you notice is how short the plants are. And the plants are about half the height. So our corn in our area is about 2 meters. We ended up with 1 meter plants in the deficit, an extreme deficit treatment. But height, really, height is a lot less important. What matters is ground cover. What matters is leaf area. And so this data from here now is, we have data from 2 years, and LAI is your leaf area per ground area, and it was from destructive sampling, and I'm showing you four of the, in all the graphs that I'll be showing the next several, it's four of the treatments just for clarity. We've got the blue treatment is our fully watered, yellow is our 65% deficit in the two phases, and then 40 is in red. The light blue is the treatment that started out with 65% deficit in the vegetative period and then went up to 80% ET in the second period. So the take-home message from this is that although the canopy cover took a little bit longer to get in the even our most extreme treatment, it did eventually reach full cover. So 80% light interception is what we consider full cover for maize. And so you see it in this picture that when it's curled, the plants look like a pineapple, but you put the water back on, and those leaves uncurl, and you do have a lot of leaf area that the plant can do something with. So this here now is our light interception, so we could monitor light interception more frequently through the season. And you also see the oscillations in canopy, in the curling response now from the light interception. And again, all treatments, soon after, so the white areas of the graph are where we have our stress treatments, and the gray are where we have our full irrigation periods. And the full irrigation here now starts at VT, which is as the plants are going into flowering. And the just showing you again that the plants do reach full light interception among all the treatments. This now is fluorescence. So the plants also down-regulate their capacity. So to maintain the structures for photosynthesis is very expensive for the plant. So as a plant is going into stress, it's not instantaneous. It takes a couple of weeks, but then they down-regulate their photosynthetic capabilities to save resources. Plants aren't stupid. So this is basically to show that these plants then, they also ramp back up when the water becomes available. So the stress that we were imposing is a minor stress in that the plants doesn't push them to the point of no return. So in 2012, we didn't quite reach full capacity, although we might have if we had taken another measurement. In 2013, we were measuring more frequently, and we see that it takes a couple of weeks to recover, but the plants do have no significant difference once they've been given water again for a couple of weeks. So the combined effect of that is what we see in our yield by water interactions. And so now here we have yields by water, and the curves in black are the curves that we have for that are fit through the treatments that have the same deficits in the two stress periods. And so the stats that were run on this are for every single treatment that we have, looking at if that treatment was significantly different than the ET extrapolated from the fit line. And so what we have are three treatments in 2012 and two treatments in 2013. that had very much lower than expected yield. And those are treatments, as it turns out, that had more water in the late vegetative, and then we cut that water off. So what's really, really interesting about this is that the yields are lower. And so this is a treatment. This one here, for example, had 100% of ET during the vegetative, and then we went to 50% of ET in the maturation, and yields really crashed. And they actually were lower than other treatments that used overall the season less water. And so, you know, really, you know, when we started this work, we really wanted, basically, we wanted to see treatments out here. Well, we wanted to see if we could bend the line, and we did that. But we also wanted to see if we could get any treatments out here, and that we didn't see. But we do have, you know, a very strong cautionary tale for producers who might feel that they don't have the ability to schedule irrigation, and they want to schedule irrigation when they have that water. They want to put it on because they're afraid that they might not have it later on in the season. But they could actually hurt themselves worse than if they had been a little bit more held back on that water, even if they don't have it at the end of the season, because they can still end up with better yields by holding back. This now is showing basically where our harvest index lies. So harvest index is basically probably one of the truest ways of looking at water use efficiency. And the treatments now with the arrows are the ones that differ significantly in harvest index. So this treatment here, which is the one treatment that we had that had more stress during the vegetative than the maturation phase. And it's the one that has significantly highest water use efficiency. It's saving about 17-18% of water with no statistically significant decrease in yield. But it has significantly highest harvest index. And the treatments that had more deficit during the maturation that really crash are the ones that have the lowest water use efficiency. So just to conclude, we may be able to increase water use efficiency in maize by imposing more deficits to control plant size during the late vegetative stages and saving that irrigation for grain fill. Or even if we don't, we can still precondition and buffer the impact of not having enough water by doing so. Ultimately, we've gone on to do some economic modeling. The economic modeling that we've done with this data so far hasn't been, it's been very much more intricate than what's come before it. But there's still room to do more. To take a look back at this, basically we're saving about 17%, but of water with no statistically significant yield. However, there is still marginally higher, although not significantly higher, yield in those treatments. So basically the economic modeling is telling us that although it's not statistically significant, it's still, in the economic modeling, significant enough that without taking into account and making the models a little bit more sophisticated and being able to add in cost of leasing that water, it is telling us that right now, within a very narrow margin, it's in the producer's best interest to give full irrigation. So the water has to get about 10 times more expensive before it will be in the producer's best interest to deficit irrigate in these systems, which for us is actually just around the corner because we're already seeing some of those prices from oil and gas is taking out long-term leases on the water in those price ranges, however. So our next steps, myself and we have another plant physiologist in the unit, from here basically we would like to move, you know, with these questions we were trying to move basically out here. Ultimately, we want to move yields up here, and the way that we're going to do that, the only way to do that is with better genetics. And so there are some goals that we have for increasing the genetics through, or really finding is that the hydraulic physiology for these plants has really been underappreciated, and there's some very tantalizing avenues for increasing, improving yields by going in some of these directions. And with that, I will thank you all for listening, and we certainly have several people to thank that were involved in running our farm and collecting the data for this project. So.